Thank you for joining us for Sound Reasoning with Christian apologist and minister Perseus Poku of Sound Reasoning Ministries. It's our prayer that today's program will educate, train, and empower you to defend your Christian faith with confidence. Perseus has his bachelor's in history and a master's degree in apologetics. We hope you enjoy this time of equipping so that you can answer questions to defend your Christian faith effectively. Now here's Perseus Poku on Sound Reasoning.
Welcome to Sound Reasoning. I'm your host, Perseus Poku. On today's episode, I'm so excited. We're going to talk about God's crime scene, and I'll explain in a few seconds. But a couple of years ago, we had the privilege of having J. Warner Wallace to come on the show and to talk to us about Cold Case Christianity. And that book, it's an excellent book dealing with proof for God and things of that nature. And this subsequent book dealing with God's crime scene, again, the Lord has inspired him to use some of his detective expertise along with some sound apologetical methods to help us to defend the reason for God's existence. So we want to welcome Brother J. Warner Wallace to the show. Welcome, Brother Wallace.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to talking to you again. That's only been maybe a year or so, a year and a half ago.
That's right.
Talk about the first book.
So I know.
Glad to be back. Yeah, it was fun.
My first question is, how is this book different from your Cold Case Christianity book?
You know, in some ways we all write books that just trace our own personal journeys. And when I was an atheist at 35, kind of sifting through the evidence and the scripture to determine whether or not I should trust what the New Testament had to say about Jesus, I did get to a place where I felt like, you know, I'm really comfortable and confident in the reliability of these documents, given the kind of test I might give them. But the problem you have is, they're talking about a guy who rose from the dead. And that, you know, for somebody who had a philosophically natural presupposition like me,
right,
I wasn't willing to accept that aspect of the story. So I would have said this is some form of historical fiction, but this couldn't be true. This part couldn't be true. And so that kind of caused me to take another step. And that second step was simply this. It was, hey, do I have a good reason to believe that my presuppositions about naturalism were actually true? Or was I assuming something that wasn't true necessarily, and that really colored the way I saw that the New Testament? So I really had to go back and take a second step, which is to say, okay, do I really think I can account for everything in my worldview evidentially as a philosophical natural, as an atheist? Is supernaturalism, this idea that there's something more than just the space, time, matter, and the laws of physics in the universe that stands outside the universe and has created everything and has guided everything and might even be capable of intervening in a natural universe, is that even a reasonable? Because that was the thing that was keeping me from looking at Jesus as anything more than just a simple preaching rabbi. And so that was the second part of my journey, and I'm kind of covering that in this second book. So that first book is really about, do we think that the New Testament documents are reliable? That's really the first one. The second one is really about, well, what is the case for God's existence in general? Or, you know, so really attacking and looking directly at whether or not naturalism, atheism, can explain the universe we live in.
And to those that are listening, God's Crime Scene, this new book that Brother Wallace have written, I was sharing with him off air that it's an excellent read. It really helps us to better digest the arguments and some of the evidence for why God exists and some of the things we can look at to recognize his fingerprints. So my next question to you, Brother Wallace, is, in the book you talked about when you first started out that you thought the universe was closed. So can you talk about that particular reference in terms of the universe being closed and how you realize that it's not closed?
Well, so a lot of what we do as homicide detectives is we get called out all the time to scenes that are death scenes. We call these DBRs, dead body reports. You get there's a dead body. Okay. Now, there's four ways to die. Only one way is murder. You can die accidentally. You can die naturally. You can commit suicide. And then, of course, you can also be murdered. So the question we usually have, the very first question is, well, do we have a murder here? Because if we have no murder, we're not going to work. It's a totally different category. And so we have to determine whether or not this is murder or or something else. And how we do this, one of the simplest things we do, and I don't know if people have ever really thought about this, and even some of the detectives that I train and police officers I train haven't necessarily thought of it this way until you kind of show them. And that's this. If the question is, can I explain everything inside the room by staying inside the room? If I can, it's probably not a homicide. So, for example, if I've got a gunshot injury and I've got a pistol in the room, but that pistol belongs to the victim and there is no evidence an intruder's been in the room and all the fingerprints and DNA in the room come back to the victim, including the DNA and fingerprints on the gun, well, then this is not going to be a homicide because I can explain everything in the room by staying in the room. This is an accident or a suicide. Now, if on the other hand, that gun is not registered to him and it's got foreign fingerprints and DNA on that gun and there's actually a sign of an entry and there's footprints leading, you know, bloody footprints leading out of the room, well, that's very different. I cannot explain those things by staying in the room for an answer. I have to go outside the room for an answer on that one. And that's when you have good reason to believe you've got an intruder and that someone has entered the scene from the outside. So if we took the same approach to the universe and we simply said this, can we explain everything we see in the universe by staying inside the room of the universe? If we can, then some form of naturalism, evolutionary processes involving space, time, and matter, the laws of physics, the laws of chemistry, can explain all of it. If on the other hand, there are things in the room that cannot be explained by staying in the room, well, then you have to go to the most reasonable inference of an intruder, and that's kind of, I think, a good kind of a template that we can use as I actually identify 8 pieces of evidence in the room that everyone has to explain, whether you're a philosophical naturalist and an atheist or whether you're a believer of any stripe. You've got to explain these 8 things, and I think they're reasonable for us to explain, and as you examine them, I think it does point more reasonably to a source, a first cause outside the room rather than something inside the room.
It reminds me so much of Thomas Aquinas's of 5 arguments, but you modernize it and makes those principles plain. So I do appreciate that as well. Can you share with us the questions that detectives ask as it relates to causation?
Yeah, you know, first thing we're going to do is kind of think about, well, you know, there's several issues in the crime scene involving evidence. You know, the first book I did was really person-centric, and sometimes you have cases that are centered on people and their testimony, right? And so you gain a skill set related to interviews, you gain a skill set related to witness reliability, and that's kind of the stuff that I talk about in the first book. But here we have the beginning of the universe, or we have a universe in which we don't have any living eyewitnesses, you know, that we can go out and interview. So what you have to do here is something different. This is true kind of crime scene profiling, where you come in and you look at the evidence in the crime scene and you try to get some idea of, having no idea who the suspect may be, but you have the evidence in the crime scene. And now this is a crime scene centric investigation in which you're really looking at evidence in the room to try to tell you something about who might have been there. And that's what we're doing here. And one of the first things you have to do with any piece of evidence in a crime scene is ask, you know, some questions related to causation. What I mean is, the first one is kind of, well, how did this originate? How did this piece of evidence originate in this room? What brought it here? Has it been here all along? Was it here before the crime occurred? Is it from the victim? Is it from an intruder who came and left it? And then, of course, the next question in that sequence is causation. Okay, if it is something that originated at some point in a sequence of events, what caused it to originate? And the third point would be explanation. So you go from origination to causation to explanation. So this is kind of the stuff that we do with every single piece of evidence in any crime scene. And what we're going to look at in God's crime scene, the book, the very first piece of evidence we have to look at is, well, okay, the origin of the universe. You know, before we can, it's almost like we'd say, hey, we've got a room with some evidence in it, but we have to explain how the room got here.
Right.
So this is one of the first questions we're going to ask. And does this tell us anything about a first cause? So I do think origination is one of the, we start with that in the first chapter, and I think it is powerful. What I try to do is give you a set of principles that detectives use dealing with evidence, and then apply that to each chapter's theme. So you're going to get a cop story at the beginning of each chapter with some skill set you're going to have to use as you kind of walk through that crime scene or walk through that sequence of events. And then we're going to take that skill set and apply it to something in the universe to see how how it transfers. And that's kind of what this whole principle of this book is.
And the book is so dynamic that we also are blessed by your artwork, which helps us to better understand some of the arguments that you're making. So, again, if you're listening to us, we are on air with J. Warner Wallace, the author of Cold Case Christianity and now God's Crime Scene. And again, we encourage you to get the book and to read it and digest the material. I think it's a powerful tool and necessary tool in your evangelism. So please go out and get it. So my next question deals with the second law of thermodynamics. Can you please explain what the second law states and how that relates to God's existence?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the thing here is that we are looking at why do we believe for an instant that we need to explain the origination of the universe. I mean, there are lots of folks for generations and centuries until the last century, believed that this universe had no reason to be explained,
right?
Because it was eternal. It has always been here. It's, as you know, some folks have famously said in the past, it's all that ever is, all that ever was, all that ever will be. So the question becomes, well, is that true? Because if it's true, then there's no reason for us to spend a lot of time kind of looking for a cause of a universe that could really be uncaused because it's eternal. Now, there are several pieces of evidence in very different disciplines that all point to one reality, that we are in a universe that is a caused universe, that it has a beginning. And so there are very different kinds of evidence that point to this. One of these is the second law of thermodynamics. It's basically about a quantity of energy in a closed, isolated system, that any quantity of energy in a closed system, like the universe itself, it remains the same, but the amount of usable energy deteriorates gradually over time. Now, that really helps us because, in other words, let's put it this way. Usable energy eventually deteriorates. We know this from our own practical experience. We learn about it in high school, but we also see it in our lives. We would live eternally if not for the second law of thermodynamics. Things move from order to disorder, from usable energy to a rise in what we call entropy, which is the kind of chaos and unusable energy. And we see this all the time. Now, why does this point to something powerful for us as believers? Well, because of this. If you think about it, if you walked into a room tomorrow, and you were the first person in the room. You knew you were the first person in the room. But when you got in the room, you saw a little wind-up, say, police car toy that's running around the room in a circle. Well, the second thing you're going to look for after seeing that police car is for the person who wound it up, because you know if it's a wind-up toy, it hasn't been running overnight. There's no toy that runs that long. It's on a fixed amount of usable energy. It is unwinding, and because it's still moving around the room in front of you, it's reasonable for you to look for the winder, because it couldn't have been that long ago that winder would have wound it, because it still has energy in it. And so the same thing is happening here. We're in a universe that appears to have some wind left in it. It's winding down toward a cold heat death, but the point is it has wind left in it now. And so that tells us that we should be looking for something that has, at one point we know for something for sure, at some point in the past, it was very tightly wound, and it is now winding out, winding down. And if the universe was eternally old and had no beginning, why would we expect there to be any wind left in this toy? There'd be no wind left in it. We'd have been energy less. But, of course, the fact that we still have some usable energy that is winding out is because it points to a beginning in which, not too long ago, in which we had a lot of highly wound universe, in essence. So that analogy, although it's not perfect, gives you an idea of why the second law of thermodynamics does point to a universe that has a beginning. And you know why that's important, because in the end, if the universe is not eternal and it has a beginning, well, then all of us are looking for what would have caused this, because that principle of causality says that anything that has a beginning has a beginner, has something that caused it. So the question then is, well, what would cause this universe? What could be powerful enough? And, of course, if it caused the universe, if it brought all space, time, and matter into being, this thing we're looking for is an eternal, uncaused first cause of all space, time, and matter. And by the way, even atheists are looking for the eternal uncaused first cause. They might propose that it's a quantum environment or it's a multiverse generator, but they're also proposing that it's an eternal uncaused first cause. But we also know that that thing is going to be spaceless, timeless, and atemporal, because those are the very things that this thing creates. So what could be eternal, all-powerful, spaceless, timeless, atemporal, and actually, I think in some ways we're looking for either a personal or an impersonal first cause. So do you see how even with the very first piece of evidence, we're forcing ourselves outside the room of the natural universe and looking for some first cause that has certain characteristics? And already, and by the way, even the atheist physicists now are looking for something outside the natural universe that's either going to be a multiverse generator of some sort or a quantum environment of physics that somehow creates the universe. In any case, they have already stepped outside the room for an explanation. And that ought to give all of us pause, because we're really looking for something that's outside the room. And the only thing that separates us really from our atheist friends on this regard is that first cause an impersonal law of physics, right, of some sort, or is it a personal being? So that's why I think it's so helpful to take this, you know, step-by-step approach in describing the first cause.
You also mentioned in the book about the fine-tuning of the universe. And I especially like the part about the bacterial flagellum. Can you touch on that? I thought that that portion of the book was just excellent in buttressing your point about someone who we know is God, as Christians, intentionally creating something on a complex level where it couldn't be by random chance.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because what happens here is that it's pretty much stipulated by believers and non-believers alike that the biological systems, biological organisms, have the appearance of design. And even a Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, who's a very committed atheist evolutionist, kind of says, well, yeah, I agree that all of biology is an attempt to describe or account for the appearance of design. Of course, he would reject that there's a designer, but everyone recognizes, boy, this stuff sure appears to be designed. And the kind of the icon of all of biological design features has become this little motor that drives bacteria called a bacterial flagellum. And this bacterial flagellum, it looks an awful lot like a rotary engine that you see in other machines that we all know are designed. As a matter of fact, we didn't even discover the bacterial flagellum until the late 70s. And when we discovered it, we were already building similar rotary-type engines on our own. And now we discover one that looks a lot like ours, but it's in biological structure of the bacteria. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, it's got 40 proteins that come together to build this machine. All 40 proteins have to be in place at once in order for the machine to work. If evolution is going to get us there, it has to get us there step by step over a long period of time. And each step has to provide something that benefits the bacteria so that it'll be retained for the next generation. So you need to figure out how that two-protein machine, what did it do? How did it survive? The three-protein machine, what did it do? How did it survive? And you've got to go up that pathway from 0 to 40. So this is one thing that Michael Behe, the biochemist from Lehigh University, said, hey, this sign of irreducible complexity where you have to have 40 things all together at once is a sure sign of design. I've tried to take it one step further. I actually think, the reason why we have so many illustrations in this book is because I spent so many years as a designer before I became a police officer. Mm. And so I've, 9 years of art school. What does it do for you? It gets you a chance to illustrate your book. That's about it. But in the end, I started to look at my own design, illustrations, the artwork, the buildings. I was in architecture, so the buildings I had designed, and I said, okay, what is it about these pieces of art that demonstrate the need for an artist, or the best explanation being an artist? What are the actual attributes of design that we take for granted that exist that help us to think through and identify something as a designed object? I actually think there are 8 things. Now, I'm not going to go through all this with you right now, but you saw in the book, I build a case for these 8 features that are commonly associated with design, and I show how this is apparent even in a bird, like a bird's nest. Mm-hmm. When you see a bird's nest perfectly formed in a tree, you don't assume it just grew in the tree that way.
Right.
It's because it demonstrates so many of these eight attributes. And by the way, it only demonstrates maybe five of them or six of them. So you don't need all eight to be demonstrated to know that it's been designed. Well, the bacterial flagellum, I think, actually contains all eight attributes. Mm. We would never reject other designed objects that demonstrate these eight attributes. Why in the world? So what I try to do in this book is show you why I think that's an affirmative case for the involvement of a designer. But even better yet, I go through all the naturalistic explanations for how you might get that little bacterial flagellum. Those are efforts to stay inside the room of the universe to explain it. And I show you why those simply don't work.
Right.
So not only do you have bad explanations from inside the room, you have the most reasonable inference of a designer outside the room. And I think that's the kind of combination we're looking for. When I'm working at a crime scene, I need to know, do I have no good reason to believe this is a suicide? Because the evidence in the room is not sufficient to support that. Hmm. And also, do I have good reason to know I need to go outside the room for a suspect? It's the combination of those two things that's very powerful.
Brother Wallace, thank you so much for your time. We've certainly have been helped by this interview and this dialogue, and we pray that we get another opportunity to talk to you and even meet with you soon. So thank you for doing the show.
Well, I can tell you're doing important work, and I'm just glad to be a small part of it.
Thank you, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, thanks so much.
That was Brother J. Warner Wallace. Author and contributor to Dateline. If you've ever seen the Dateline shows where they're dealing with crime scene investigation, he's one of the consultants, and he's been on the show a few times, and I believe he still works with them. But in any case, he is a Christian author, and I believe his publications are very necessary and beneficial to God's church. So please get his book, God's Crime Scene. It has a lot of scientific data that will help we as Christians witness to those in our lives that may be coming from a naturalistic paradigm, those individuals who claim that God did not create the universe, but we got here through random selection. So in any case, we pray that you've been edified by this episode of Sound Reasoning. And as always, please help us to continue to train Christians in sound doctrine. We need your financial support. Thank you so much for listening to Sound Reasoning. And may God continue to bless you and your family as we endeavor to do for the truth what so many other people do for a lie.
Thanks for listening to Sound Reasoning with apologist and minister Perseus Poku from Sound Reasoning Ministries. It's our prayer that today's lesson has equipped you to share and defend your Christian faith with boldness. Sound Reasoning Ministries offers training in apologetics, biblical studies, and systematic theology. Join in on discussions on Facebook at Sound Reasoning Ministries. For more information about the ministry, to send an email, ask a question, or support the ministry, visit online at srministries.org. That's srministries.org. Listen again next week at this same time, and remember, Titus 1:9 says, "Hold firm to the trustworthy message as has been taught, so that you can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it." Sound Reasoning Ministries, srministries.org.
If you're hearing this right now, you're probably like, who the heck is this? And why are they playing during my favorite podcast? And I get it. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I do want to introduce myself. My name is Trevor Tyson, and I'm the host of Trevor Talks, where we talk to real people about real topics and real stories. I just want to invite you, if you love podcasts, if you love music, if you love books and love hearing from the people who create it, come check us out at Trevor Talks. Simply go to Google or Life Audio, type in Trevor Talks, and it'll pop on up. Hope you have a great day.